Your call is now live.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to Creating a Respiratory Protection Program, going to be presented by Eileen Franco, Director, Bureau of Occupational Health at the New York State Department of Health. This program is sponsored by NYASA Services in conjunction with New York Association of Homes and Services for the Aging and the Foundation for Long-Term Care. We're really, really happy to be able to do this today, and we have a lot of information, and I'm sure you have a lot of questions, and Eileen is ready to go. So I'll turn it out over to Eileen. Thanks, Eileen.
Hi, thank you very much. This is Eileen Franco. As she said, I'm from the New York State Department of Health, and before I worked for the New York State Department of Health, I was an industrial hygienist with with OSHA, and before that I was a sanitarian for a county health department. So I've had a lot of different experiences with respirators as well as compliance with them. And I know that you're all long-term care facilities from New York State, so I guess I can talk about what's been going on in New York State in the last couple of weeks. There was a Dear Administrator letter that went out to all of the facilities, and that really talked about the fact that you will be required to be creating a respiratory protection program, which I know sent people into some angst. And then it talked about working with our bureau as well as the Occupational Health Clinic Network, which is in all across New York State. After that, there was a 6-question survey, and really it was just basic information because I was trying to find out, how do I know exactly what people have and where they stand? I know that there was a critical asset survey that had been done with respiratory protection, but that didn't really tell me much about where people stood. I was actually trying to prioritize which nursing homes and long-term care facilities to reach out to first. Of course, that also caused people quite a bit of angst, and I had probably about 75 or 80 phone calls from people wondering how to fill out the survey. Interestingly enough, if I would hurry up and send them a written program so that they could answer the question, yes, they had one, and I would explain that, in fact, the survey came to me, so they'd already told me they didn't have one, so they had to be honest now, which was actually somewhat comical. So the people that called me, what I did was I took some basic information from them regarding the respiratory protection program and linked them up with an occupational health clinic that was in their basic jurisdiction. Some of the other facilities, what I've been doing too, is sending out an email that included a template for a written respiratory protection program and information on the CDC guidelines. And one of the things, before we even get into what's required to create a respiratory protection program, is basically the CDC guidelines and what they're saying. And if you've read it, it really talks about a hierarchy of control. And as an industrial hygienist, which my mom always thought meant I clean teeth in the industry, but it doesn't. It's really someone who deals with occupational injury and illness and how to control them. Hierarchy of controls is something that we've been dealing with for years. And it talks really about eliminating the potential exposures. It talks about engineering controls, administrative controls, and personal protective equipment. And what we're talking with is with the long-term care facilities about is, how do you really do that? Now, there's been a lot of talk lately about the prioritization of N95 respirators and whether or not you can be in priority mode. And the thing is that if you continue to do business as usual, you are going to run out of respirators probably within a couple of days if you even have any. So the hierarchy of controls, what it does is it helps you to realize that you need to change the way you do business when you have a patient with influenza-like illness. And looking at the handout that you were provided, it talks about creating a respiratory protection program. And the reason I talk about the engineering controls, and we'll go into that a little bit more, but there's a lot of requirements. You can't just hand someone on your staff a respirator. You really must do quite a lot to be in compliance with OSHA if you're a private facility, or PESH if you're a public facility. And the next question that people always ask is respirator the first line of defense and the best method to protect employees from H1N1? And the answer to that is no. And you should look to the CDC guidelines to find out what they make as recommendations for the hierarchy of control. But it really is a sit down and sort of look at how you do business and what you can do to utilize these controls as much as possible. And the hierarchy of controls is really elimination of the potential sources of exposure, engineering, administrative, and last, personal protective equipment. When you're looking at the elimination of the potential exposures, it's things like keeping someone with influenza-like illness away from your facility. Now, with your patients, that might not be as easy. I had quite a few of the long-term care facilities that I talked to said, well, if we have a patient with ILI, we just ship them off to a hospital. And if that's what you do, then that's basically eliminating the person with influenza-like illness. Now, from speaking with a lot of other facilities, that's not a luxury that most people have. And the thing is that's going to make this different this season is that with a lot of people going to hospitals, the hospitals are going to be overcrowded, and they're going to reach their surge capacity, and they're going to start to push patients out to the long-term care facilities. So where you are today doesn't necessarily reflect how many patients you have with ILI coming. And the people that said, well, we're just going to send our patients with ILI to the hospital, that luxury may also not be a capacity. The next thing with elimination of potential sources of exposure is actually looking at your staff and the people that come into the long-term care facilities. And I know there's a lot of discussion about staff not coming to work, and the whole idea with limiting the potential for exposure, the illness takes basically a bell-shaped curve, and the height of the middle part of the curve, the bell part, really depends on how fast and how many people get sick. And the idea behind all of these controls is actually take your hand and like push down the top of the bell-shaped curve and squish it out. So it makes that it's not as high of a peak, it's much longer. So the illness will be of longer duration, but the amount of people who are sick at one time is less. When we say that the best thing to do is limit persons who are sick to stay home for at least 24 hours until their illness is gone, the idea behind that is that if a person comes to work and they're sick, they're going to infect all of the people around them, not only your staff, but your patients. And then that's what contributes to the bell-shaped curve going up even higher. So the idea is to limit people who are sick from not coming to work. Postpone people who have elective visits with influenza-like illness. Ask people who are – I know that it's very difficult to say to somebody you can't come in to see your loved one. It's very difficult. But I've seen lots of signs on different places that I go to, signs that say if you're ill, you know, please choose to visit at another time. Please come back. I know some of the hospitals are limiting kids that are coming in. So if there's a way to either postpone, delay, or deny entry to someone who's sick, or the idea is to minimize it as much as possible. The next method to limit the exposure to influenza-like illness is actually an engineering control. I know AIIR rooms are one of the methods. That's probably the best example that I can give of an engineering control. And basically that was put in from the TB, and people had their airborne infection isolation rooms, which the airflow is such that the air's not going back into the rest of the facility. That's a pure engineering control, and it's to limit the exposure not only to the rest of the facility, but to the staff. Now, I know most of the facilities I talked to did not have an AIIR room, so that's not something that you're going to go and build. But there's things like partition. You can limit people's air. You could make rooms that are for people that are exhibiting illness, rooms that aren't. I know that also, again, from speaking, I learned an awful lot about long-term care facilities the next couple of years. So as I look to one for myself, I know what I should be looking for now. But the whole idea is that people don't really move from room to room. It's not like a hospital where you're in one room one day and in another. It's very disruptive to move patients. And once a patient is ill and if the roommate is in there, the chances are that they've both been exposed to the air. So there's really no reason to be moving people around. But if you can, limit exposure. You know, maybe asking that person not to go to the community room for lunch or dinner. Maybe asking them not to partake in the weekly activity that occurs, things like that. And I'm actually jumping ahead of myself. But engineering controls, again, hoods for labs, which really probably doesn't affect you, but also installation of hands-free soap and water dispensers. A couple weeks ago, I went down to New York City to speak to some long-term care facilities, and of course, I was late. But I made the joke that I don't know if anybody's traveled on the thruway lately, but they have the automatic water dispensers. Well, it only dispenses for about 6 seconds. So I commented that the reason I was late was because I had to keep trying the water to sing happy. I couldn't get through happy birthday with the water. But using hands-free soap dispensers and water dispenser also does limit it. Now, I realize, too, that engineering controls are not something that you can just put together in a matter of a couple weeks. Another one is to use closed suctioning systems. That's something that would help to limit the amount of exposure to the staff when they're performing an aerosol-generating procedure. Administrative controls, encouraging your staff to be vaccinated. It helps prevent illness between staff as well as between patients. If you can, identify and isolate the patients with ILI. However, that does prove to be difficult because you really don't know who has influenza and who has something else oftentimes. And if you have someone in a room with someone else, it's just assumed that they've been exposed to the same type of ventilation and air. Implementing respiratory hygiene and cough etiquette. Sometimes it's very difficult to change behavior, but if you can, at least amongst the staff, encourage them to use respiratory hygiene. And another easy control, which actually goes back to engineering controls, is if you have baskets, put plastic liners in them so that the cleaning staff doesn't have to come in and pick up dirty tissues. They can just pick up the bag. Use triage stations to manage patient flow. Again, that's more for a hospital setting, but you may have that capability. Use appropriate isolation precautions to try to limit the number of patients in a room during any aerosol-generating procedures. If it's possible to do these procedures with two staff, that's fine. If you need to do it with four staff, then, but you don't need to have extra people. And then the last line of defense, which is actually the reason it's the last line of defense, is that anytime you use personal protective equipment of any sort, it really depends on the user to make sure that they wear it properly. Not only do they wear it properly, but they understand the limitations, advantages, and disadvantages of it. I tell my old story about, I don't know if anybody remembers the show The Wild Kingdom that used to be on Saturday nights. And Marlon Perkins would stand there next to a pit, and this guy would be down in the pit with snakes, and Jim would look into the camera and very confidently say, "It's okay, Jim's protected. He's got Mutual of Omaha." And I can always remember thinking, Jim's an idiot, because he really wasn't protected at all. And that's one of the biggest problems with personal protective equipment. If you're using something improperly or it's not really providing you with the protection you think it is, you're likely to put yourself at risk, as Jim did with the pit of snakes, thinking that Mutual of Omaha for him was the answer to all his problems. So personal protective equipment really depends on the user wearing it appropriately, as well as using the appropriate type of equipment. And what I mean by that is, if you need certain gloves, if you need body equipment, if anybody knows much about respirators, there's different types of cartridges that go on, some of the bigger plastic ones, that the elastomeric ones. And if you have the wrong cartridge, it's actually not providing you any protection at all. And it has to function properly. It has to be properly maintained. So jumping to where we are now, what we're looking at is the long-term care facilities across New York State who have patients or will have patients that have influenza-like illness, and realizing that the guidance that's currently out from the Centers for Disease Control says that they feel that if you're within 6 feet of a patient that has influenza-like illness, the hospital or the healthcare worker should be protected. Using normal procedures, you're going to run out or you're not going to have N95. So it's time to look at these other controls now. Look at your facilities and see what you can do to minimize exposure. If you have a limited amount of respiratory protection, which you most likely will, then the thing is that you need to start to decide if you can get more, attempt to get some more, and make sure that you put a respiratory protection program into effect. And that's where I come in. And when is a respiratory protection program needed? And the answer to that is very simple. Once a facility decides they're going to have a staff or the staff needs to have a respirator, and in this case we're talking about N95 respirators, which are disposable paper masks, which are have been deemed to be effective for the influenza, like the 2009 H1N1 virus. And if you're going to provide those to staff, you need to put together a respiratory protection program. Now, I've been working trying to help some of the long-term care facilities that have contacted me, either based on the Dear Administrator letter or the six-question survey, but I still only have gotten up to about 120 out of the 639 nursing homes. I'm also looking at the critical asset survey of who says that they have a vent in their facility, which says to me there's a good possibility they have a respiratory section. So we're trying to reach out to those people. And what I'm trying to do is help you develop what's included in a respiratory protection program. Realize that the CDC came out with guidance, the health department comes out with information, but the regulators for a public entity is PESH, Public Employee Safety and Health, and a private entity is OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And the regulators are really the ones that have the ultimate say in what you do. And what they have said is that if you are going to provide a staff member with a respirator, you must have a complete respiratory protection program. So I'm not sure how many of you out there have N95s, but there are some still available, and we've also been providing some information. But what's required for a written respiratory protection program is you should have a written program. And a lot of facilities say, well, we have written protocols. A protocol for when you use a respirator is different from what's required for a written respirator program to be in compliance with OSHA and PESH. There's also a requirement that anyone who's assigned to wear a respirator, an N95 in this case, must have a medical assessment to determine if they're capable of wearing the respirator. And the reason for that is if you think about it, if someone has, say, COPD or asthma or some other respiratory ailment or is overweight, putting on a respirator actually makes it more difficult to breathe. It's like walking around with a coffee filter on your face all day. And if you try to breathe through it, it's more labor-intensive than if you don't have anything on. So putting someone that has respiratory problems or other medical problems in a respirator could put them at a risk for some health problems. So you really want to make sure that someone is capable of wearing a respirator. The next thing is you have to train the staff so that they understand the advantages, disadvantages, limitations, so we don't have gyms out there in the snake pit thinking Mutual of Omaha is everything they need. And the last thing is a fit testing procedure, which has to ensure that the respirator properly fits the person. I've had people say, well, I passed the fit test, but then every time I went and put the respirator on subsequent to that, it never seemed to fit my face right when I did my user fit check. And what that says to me is either the training wasn't sufficient. So if they fit it during the fit test, somebody helped them understand how to put a respirator on their head. And I have to admit, it's not rocket science, but there are certain things that you need to know about putting it on and taking it off, one, to make sure you don't contaminate yourself, and two, to make sure that you do get that proper fit so that air goes through the respirator, not around it. One of the big disadvantages of a face mask is that it's not a seal with your face. The seal is what makes the air go through the respirator. And obviously, when you're breathing through it, air will take the path of least resistance, so if there's any leaks in the respirator, it's going to take that path around. So you want to make sure that it properly fits the staff. And then the next question is, well, how are you going to do all that? Well, this is where we are right now. Currently, what we've developed is we're putting together information. We have a written respiratory protection program that talks about equipment selection, medical assessment, annual fit testing, and training of employees. We've put it, OSHA doesn't approve anything, but PESH looked at it and felt that it met all of their needs. So from compliance, it meets the standard. It's a template that we've been emailing to people, and it's going to be online, and you can download it and put your name on it and make sure it's applicable. The reason I think it's very important that it be emailed to people is so they have that document and you can type right in it and make it applicable to your facility. realize that this program that's in there is sort of the end all and the be all. So there may be a lot of stuff in there that you really don't do as far as certain procedures. If you have very minimal suctioning, then, you know, obviously you don't may not have as much about the selection of respiratory protection. The thing that I would caution you with that is, although we can provide you with the written respiratory protection program, I don't know if any of you, I'm sure most of you, if not all, have bloodborne pathogen standard programs, which includes a written program for that. As a former compliance officer, when I went around, if people still had their program in the cellophane or it still looked like no one had ever used it, that pretty much was an indication that it wasn't being used properly. I like to see the ones that are sort of crunkled and have crumpled and has coffee stains on it, because what that says to me is people are actually, don't go spilling coffee on it, but it says to me that people are actually using their program and looking to it as a resource. You also have to have a designated program administrator to oversee the program. That's what I've been reaching out and trying to find out who is the program. Oftentimes, it's the director of nursing, it's the administrator, it's the medical director. I also found out through the six-question survey that there's a, I don't know, it's like a BLS or, I don't know, there's some three-letter acronym for the person that fills out the survey. I quickly found out that's not the person I needed to speak to about development of a written respiratory protection program. So we're actually going to provide you with the written respiratory protection program. You need to designate a program administrator, and then the next thing is to provide equipment to employees. You have to actually get some of the respirators that are out there. Some of the questions that I've been getting are what types of respirators to buy, and there's a lot out there right now. I'm not sure you have the luxury of selecting. The OSHA standard says that you need to have a minimum of three types of respirators. Not everybody has that luxury right now of getting three different types of respirators, so I would try to get what you can. Unless you're performing some type of medical procedure, you don't need an N95 respirator that is approved. I'm sorry, that is it's by the FDA. Was it cleared by the FDA? The respirator that OSHA and PESH will be looking at and that the CDC feels is sufficient is any respirator that's approved by NIOSH. NIOSH stands for the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and what they do are they approve respirators, and you would be looking for a respirator that is an N95. N stands for not resistant to oils, and 95 stands for, and this will be on the final test, or it won't be on the final test, but it may help you get through a Jeopardy final question once. And 95 stands for the fact that the respirator is 95% efficient at filtering out 0.3 size microns, and that's considered to be effective at protecting someone from H1N1. Also, in addition to the sample program, you need to download a copy of the OSHA standard, which is 29 CFR 1910.134. It's like a 26-page standard. I didn't copy it for people because we're on a austerity budget and we're saving paper. Information on purchasing N95. We just have a variety of manufacturers that we know are selling N95, but I've seen them in Home Depot. I've seen them in Walgreens and some various places. As long as the respirator is approved by NIOSH, it's acceptable. Problem is you can't get a couple hundred of them at Walgreens and NIOSH, or Walgreens and Home Depot. We're also providing information on fit testing. The fit testing for an N95 respirator is actually, for the most part, a qualitative test, which is a yes-no rather than a numeric value. And what happens is the person puts the respirator on, and the person should put that on themselves so that they understand how to get it fitted tight to their face. The person that's doing the fit test really shouldn't do all of that. And you put the N95 respirator on, and then there's an aerosol that's put around that person, and it's either a Bitrix or a saccharin solution. Bitrix is that disgusting stuff they put in fingernail polish that you can paint on kids' fingers so they don't eat their fingernails. Anyone who's ever dealt with lead, they also put it in some paints so kids don't chew on windowsills. That is Bitrix, and it tastes very, very bitter. Saccharin, which is the stuff people know about from putting it in your coffee or hot beverage, and that will taste sweet. So if a person that's wearing a respirator and you do a fit test around them, if they can smell or taste the material in the aerosol, then you know that that respirator doesn't fit properly, and you may have to find either a different brand or a different size. One of the big questions I've had is, well, what if I don't have any other sizes or I don't have any other brands? Well, then you have to go back to step one and decide, does this person going to be someone that I assign to work around a person with influenza-like illness or who's going to be around an aerosol-generating procedure if you're in priority mode? One thing I didn't mention is that if you have decided that you're in priority mode and only using the N95 for aerosol-generating procedures, as a former compliance officer, what you need to do is at least demonstrate to the compliance office that you've attempted to get them. Maybe a letter from a couple suppliers that say they're on back order or whatever procedures or measures and steps you take to try to obtain N95s, keep it there. And although OSHA and PESH are not going to be doing, you know, going out and doing spot checking for H1N1 and respiratory protection compliance, they do inspections and investigations based on complaints. So if you have an employee, and I can tell you in the many, many years that I was a industrial hygienist for OSHA and a compliance officer, out of probably 400 or 500 facilities that I investigated, I only did one facility that was not a complaint. So people complain. Let me just tell you right now, they complain. So you want to make sure that you're in compliance. So you have to be able to prove that you at least have made a good faith effort to try to obtain N95s. The fit testing supplies, there'll also be some information on how do you obtain the fit testing supplies, a sample train the trainer program for your employees, and some other information. One of the things that I'm also working with the 3,500 school nurses across the state and what the BOCES actually came up with an idea, which I think I'm going to see how I can sort of translate into the long-term care facilities, is we're going to try to make a 7-segment training program, an online training program, sort of like you can go to for reference. And the 7 segments would be sort of an introduction to H1N1 and the CDC guidelines, introduction to a respiratory protection program, training for personal protective equipment and specifically N95s, how to perform a medical evaluation and the documentation required, how to perform a fit test, and how to perform a fit check. A fit check, just because I haven't talked about that, is when a person puts on a respirator, they do a very quick, you put your hands around the respirator and try to breathe in and see if the respirator actually has a tight seal to your face. But it's very difficult to explain it over the phone. So what this will be is like a video library where the facilities can go to down the line, and you don't want to have to watch a 2-hour video or a 1-hour video. All you want is that 4-minute segment on how do I do the fit testing again, because maybe you do it now and then you want to do it in another year. This will provide you the luxury of just going right to that video and watching the 4-minute, you know, informational session on how to do a fit check. So that's actually another project. I've been looking for work lately, so I decided to try to do something like that. We're hoping to have these segments up fairly soon. I have at least drafts of all the training programs. And then the next thing is realizing that we don't have enough staff to be able to provide this with. There's an occupational health clinic network, which is across the state, and it's been in existence since 1982, and it was created because we found that occupational illnesses such as asbestosis, silicosis, lead poisoning, metal fume fever, a lot of different occupational illnesses people have, but there was really no venue for people to go and get information on occupational health. And there's 11 clinics are located across the state, and we contract with them. They go through an RFP process, and, you know, it's a competitive process. And we've contracted with them to provide assistance to all 639 long-term care facilities across the state. And they're not going to perform your fit testing, but there's various different ways they're going to do it, but they will. If you have a written respiratory protection program, they'll help you with looking at that to make sure it meets all the requirements. If you don't have one, they'll make sure you get the one that we have and that it's filled out properly. They'll provide you with information on how to obtain supplies and provide technical guidance on any aspect that you have from the respiratory protection standard. Do you have to use them? No, you not. I've talked to a few facilities that have gone out and hired consulting firms on their own, and the luxury is yours to do that. We've just contracted with them, and I've provided the clinics with the same information that I've been providing to each one of the long-term care facilities. So right now where we are is I have all of this information done. I'm working at trying to reach out. I know if any of you out there have called me or emailed me in the last 2 days, unfortunately, I've been doing back-to-back presentations for about the last 48 hours, so I haven't returned your call. However, that's what I plan on doing all morning. So if you have called me or emailed me, I'm working at it. I promise you're in the queue. If you have not, I'm really looking for is who would you like to have contacted at your facility, and I can have the occupational health clinic network that has been assigned to you contact you. Or if you don't want their assistance and you just want the materials, you can email me, and I've been sending emails out. Or I could provide them all to your organization, which might be easier, and then they can send them all out to you. And that's really all I have. With that, I would like to open it up to questions. And
Sure.
At
this time, if you do have a question, please hit the number 1 on your phone. If your question has been answered already, hit the number 1 again to remove yourself from the queue. Give me one moment while I get our first question. Our first question today comes from Liz. Go ahead, your line is open.
Thank you. It was my understanding from the dear administrator letter that N95s are indicated for any influenza-like illness this season. And I just wanted to clarify that, because if that's the case, we need our respiratory protection plan yesterday.
You are correct.
Okay.
Yes, you are correct. The thing is that we're not really testing people. Most of the illness that we've seen to date has been H1N1. However, influenza-like illness is influenza-like illness, and we're not having to determine that it's H1N1 to use the respirator. And the CDCs, as well as the other states, and we're all acknowledging that influenza-like illness symptoms are influenza-like illness, and an N95 is the correct respirator of choice.
Okay. And so given the supply issue, is there an official guidance on prioritizing using N95s?
If you do not currently have N95s at your facility and you do have patients with influenza-like illness, then you should be at least attempting to try to obtain some N95 respirators. And I would suggest that if you're looking at that, you can contact your local health department and work with them on seeing if they have access to obtaining any.
I have one other question. Is the medical
or suppliers.
Assessment.
I'm sorry, what?
Right. I'm sorry, thank you. The medical assessment, does that have to be performed by a physician?
No.
Can it be a registered nurse?
Yes, and actually the medical assessment, if you download the standard, there's appendices that go with it, and appendices C, I think that's right. I don't have it in front of me. Appendices C, I'm pretty positive, is the medical questionnaire. So the questionnaire already exists. All you have to have is the medical questionnaire. The person that you are going to assign the respiratory protection program, I would download that from the OSHA website. It's OSHA.gov, and it's the respiratory protection medical questionnaire or medical assessment. Download that, and what you do is you just have to have a licensed healthcare professional. And it specifically states in the guidance that it does not have to be a physician. It can be any licensed healthcare physician. I'm sorry, licensed healthcare professional. And that person reviews the medical questionnaire and identifies if there's anything that they feel indicates that the person would not be a good candidate to use respirator.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. Part of the answer to that previous question was blocked out for us, so I apologize if this is
okay.
The question you already answered. But I'm concerned about that this classification of influenza-like illness is going to be interpreted so broadly. And so I wonder if the health department has any really specific criteria for what you really call influenza-like illness.
Yes, we do. And what we've been saying in our guidance, and the more specific information is at the health department website, which is www.health.state.ny.us. But what we've been saying is pretty classic for ILI is a temperature, a fever of 100 degrees or greater than 100 degrees, and either a cough or sore throat.
Okay.
And but there's a lot, if, as you can see, you obviously know, there's a lot of other symptoms that go along with it. But the ones we're sticking with is a fever of greater than 100 degrees and cough or sore throat.
Okay. And my other question is, in the meantime, when we are all, you know, in the process of getting this fit testing and programs together, what should we be doing with people who have those symptoms? Because, I mean, I don't think our hospital would even, I mean, I don't think I have doctors who would admit people to hospitals with just those symptoms.
Have you looked at the hierarchy of controls and different things that you could do from the CDC guidelines for healthcare workers?
Yes.
And were any of those applicable?
No, they are. I just don't want to be held to the standard.
Well, what
to be using N95s before we even have a chance to do this fairly extensive program?
Do you have N95s now?
We have N95s on site, but we don't have we don't have them fit tested.
Right.
We have them to use, but we don't have the fit testing done.
Well, I would say that it is, and again, I'm not the regulator, so I can make any recommendation, but, you know, the idea is that the respirator does provide protection. And at this point in time, until you have the fit testing, actually the fit test, I can probably give you the phone number for a clinic if you know, tell me where you're located, but and they could hopefully help you with the fit testing very quickly. But it is far better to wear if you put a respirator on and you haven't had the luxury of being fit testing, for whatever reason you're waiting for the materials or the supplies, if you put a respirator on and you hold your hands as much as possible around the respirator and breathe in to see if it actually comes closer to your face, or breathe out and see if it sort of puffs up a little, that will tell you whether or not it fits your face properly. And, I mean, in lieu of anything else, I don't advocate doing that. I would advocate for trying to get the materials and performing fit testing. But it is better, although Jim wasn't protected, I guess it's better to wear a respirator when in doubt than not to wear any at all.
Okay. And would you just clarify that they are not single use, that we would be reusing them and maybe putting another mask on top of them, because that's what I've heard previously?
There has been some information out there about putting other masks over them. I'm not sure of the efficacy of that, but what I can tell you is that N95 respirators are considered typically for normal use. They are disposable in between each patient. And in this time, you know, that's not really a luxury that we have. As long as a respirator is still intact, if it's visibly soiled, if you're doing an aerosol generating procedure and it's wet or it's visibly contaminated with, you know, liquids, body fluids, obviously then you would want to discard it. If you're walking, if it's not visibly soiled, say if you're in a room with some sort of aerosol generating procedure but you're not very close, or you have enough where you can use them for, you know, coming in within 6 feet of a patient, you can reuse those. And, you know, you could put them in like a plastic bag. Remember that the actual outside of the respirator has a good potential to be, you know, have virus on it, because it's actually acting as you're breathing. So you'd want to make sure that you didn't touch the outside of it, and then, you know, you'd want to wash your hands immediately thereafter. So still using good universal precautions, but you do not have to discard them in between each, you know, coming in contact with a patient with ILI.
Okay.
And that's actually Centers for Disease Control, as well as OSHA and PESH, have also recognized that.
Okay. All righty. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, the thing with a respirator, you're welcome, is you want to make sure that it's still, the integrity is still there. I mean, I have a N95 respirator that was in the trunk of my car for about 5 years after World Trade Center. And, you know, I finally pulled it out of the bottom of my trunk, and, you know, the thing was crushed and the straps had degraded. You want to make sure that there's integrity with the straps, that it can still form a good fit, and that it, you know, it still maintains its shape.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Sonia. Go ahead.
The question I need to ask, prior to the H1N1, our respiratory protection program was basically for the airborne organism, for, say,
TB.
Right. And we, based on the CDC guideline, the risk level scoring, we were low. And OSHA then had a stipulation where you could waive the refitting. Now, with the H1N1, you're saying that we should be fitted annually, everyone?
Yes, the standard says is that, and again, there's been no waiving of any of this annual fit testing at all. But if the person has been fit tested within a year, I mean, if you perform annual fit testing and it's been done within, you know, if you have a staff person that was fitted a year ago and you still have the same respirators and it's the same type respirator, the only time you have to refit a person is if the person gains or loses 10 pounds, gets, I think it's contacts or false teeth, or there's a bunch of facial changing characteristics. I'd like to lose that 10 pounds, but so far I haven't done it. I'll do anything to get fit tested again. But that person needs to be refitted, or if the respirator that they were fitted for is no longer available, you need to do a new fit for the next respirator because it's going to fit them differently.
So you're saying if the facial structures change, then we need to do a refitting. If
yes.
It's the same mask, we don't have to do the refit.
Correct.
Annually?
If you've done it within a year, you do not have to do a refit test, as long as you're providing them the same respirator. So if they fit, say, a Moldex medium and, you know, and it was 9 months ago and you still have Moldex mediums and that's what you're assigning to the staff person, you're good to go. All those little nuances of the gain and lose 10 pound, everything, they're actually in the 1910.134 standard. If you're interested in, talks about fit testing and the frequency.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Zany. Go ahead.
We would like to get the website for downloading the template for sample written program.
Right now, someone told me it was on the HPN, but I didn't know it was there because I have a copy of it right in front of me, and I'm going to make one change to it. The occupational health clinic will be able to email it to you. Is that what you're talking about, the written program?
Yes.
Or I can email it to your organization, and then they can provide it to you.
Okay. I'll email you, and then
you can email me.
Yes. Who to email?
My email address is okay. E, as in elephant, or Eileen, M, as in Marie, F, as in Franco, 03@health.state.ny.us. I'll say that again. EMF03@health.state.ny.us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Frank. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm an adult home. We don't have any aerosol treatments. We don't have a respiratory program right now. We were in a conversation earlier that said we're not under Article 28 facility. Do we have to have use N95s?
The Article 28 facility is actually whether or not you're under the New York State Department of Health regulations. Not being an Article 28 facility makes no difference at all to OSHA or PESH.
Okay.
So it's still your healthcare facility, you're still healthcare workers. If you're saying that at this point in time you don't have any patients with ILI and you're not doing any aerosol generating procedures, then what OSHA and PESH look at is whether or not you have an ILI person. They're not they're only looking at aerosol generating procedures if you can prove that you're in priority mode and saving respirators only for aerosol generating procedures. So currently, if you have no ILI patients, you're in compliance. But as soon as you get a person with influenza-like illness, and again, look to those hierarchy controls. See if you can keep it out of your facility. Don't let your staff come to work sick. You know, try to restrict people who are ill from coming to visit. The longer you can delay the illness in your facility, the better off you are.
Right. So as soon as you have an ILI, you have to have the N95.
Correct.
Now, like I said, we're only a 26-bed facility, and what happens if you have, all of a sudden, you don't have staff? I mean, there's so many guidelines that you don't have staff to, you know, capable to do that. Do you have to then, at that point, you know, you have to have the resident leave?
Well, that doesn't sound like a really feasible solution, but, you know, you can obtain N95 respirators. You know, you'd need a limited supply, and we can provide you with all the other information. So I guess what I'm saying is that you know, if we had said on your own, you need to provide a respiratory protection program, thanks for playing, you know, and walked away, I can see where that would have been very cumbersome. But at this point in time, the state health department is helping everyone understand what's required and come up to speed on this. So I guess what I'm saying is we're offering you the assistance to come up to speed.
Right. If I don't have N95 masks, say I do get my fit testing in place.
Well, you'd have to have at least some masks to get fit tested, because we need to know what you are going to be wearing to fit test you for.
All right, so I have to have them. In the meantime, we spoke with somebody else earlier today that said for routine care, the surgical mask would be sufficient.
Oh, was that on the 11 o'clock call?
Yes.
I think I got on for like 10 minutes of that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the next best thing.
Okay.
So, I mean, you can in the interim, but I would suggest, I mean, obviously that the N95s, if you could obtain them, and work with your local health departments.
Right.
If you have questions on that.
So we would be in compliance as long as we're moving forward to try and get this in place and get the mask and everything.
Correct.
And use the surgical mask right now, we are in compliance.
Right. And even if you were a 5-bed facility, if you have, you know, 2 or 3 staff persons that don't feel that you have made, you know, a good faith effort to protect them while they're at work and they complain, you're an employer. An employee-employer relationship exists anytime there's one employee.
Right.
I mean, actually, you can, to really be technical, you can be your own employee. If I pay myself rather than just take the profits, then you're your own employee. So if I own the company and I'm the only employee and I pay myself a salary, I know it's kind of silly, but I'm responsible to train myself.
Right.
So, you know, the Article 28 and the number, OSHA kicks in with any number of employees.
Right.
So there's no magic number that you need to be below before OSHA is applicable.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Why do I feel like Frasier on the phone?
Our next question comes from John. Go ahead. John?
Hello, John. I'm listening.
Yeah, we have an individual here at our nursing home that provides direct patient care, and he has a very short beard, and he has a negative for the Bitrex test. Is that okay for him to continue to be very closely shaven but not completely beardless and wear the N95?
So he's got like a 5 o'clock shadow?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, technically, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, if he can fit it, I mean, then it sounds like it's fitting him. However, the OSHA standard says is that you're not supposed to have any facial hair. So I would say that if you were reading the standard, that he should be clean shaven when he uses it. Because obviously, even the little hairs, the reasoning behind that is it does create a small gap between the fit, the respirator, and your face.
I see. And as far as actually acquiring the N95s, is there any place you're aware we can collect them en masse and not just a few here and there?
As far as I know, I mean, there are salespeople out there that you can buy. I've heard that there's any ones that are not FDA cleared, I heard that you can get those fairly easily, because the FDA cleared ones are being used specifically for hospitals for things like surgery. So I would say to look for a NIOSH approved one. And again, if you are a facility and you've been trying to get them and can't, contact your local health department, because there is some supplies that will be provided to the local health departments that will be specifically deemed for healthcare workers. And I know that some of them are not, and I believe this was also mentioned on the last call, that if anybody's on that 11 o'clock with the state health department, is that your local health departments are making assessments now on what might be needed in their community. So I would reach out to your local health department and have the discussion with them if you really can't find any.
So one last question. If in theory, it sounds like if we have one individual here with ILI symptoms, that individual and the people caring, not that individual, but the people directly caring for them should wear the N95.
If you can't perform any of the hierarchy of controls according to the CDC guidelines. But obviously if you're dealing with a patient and taking vitals, or, I mean, you can't use any other controls for that. So that at this point, if you can obtain respirators, that's what you should be using. And until you can run out and you can demonstrate you don't have any, then you can prioritize that just for aerosol-generating procedures.
Okay, thank you.
Next question comes from Gerard. Go ahead.
I believe you answered this question from earlier, but I just want to make sure. On the slide you said you stated about materials available, all of those materials will be sent to us if we email you?
What I will email you back is a sample of a written program. I will not send you the standard. You have to copy that yourself.
And that's from OSHA.gov, right?
Yep. I will send you information on purchasing N95s, information on purchasing fit testing supplies. The information on the fit testing is actually part of the standard, and I'll email you a sample training program. And the occupational health clinics will also provide it, or you can work through your association.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jude. Go ahead.
Yes, I think you've answered the question for me. It's pretty obvious, but I'm concerned because we keep getting confusing information, whether you're required to wear it when you're doing a procedure or whether first-line caregivers are required or is it just recommended. Common sense says that they should be wearing them if that's what's necessary, but I don't know who's directing this. Is it OSHA? Is it the CDC?
Well, the CDC, and let me see if I can explain this because it does get somewhat confusing. The Centers for Disease Control put out guidance, and the guidance, no one's required to follow it. However, the regulators set the standard. So the regulators are the ones that say, this is what you must do. You know, it's sort of like a police officer. You know, I might live on a street and I say, you know, it's recommended that you go 30 miles an hour. But the police officer says, but the speed limit's 20. Well, the speed limit by, you know, if you don't follow the compliance directive, if you don't follow what the regulators say, you're subject to penalties and fines. So what I can tell you is that PESH and OSHA are going to enforce what the CDC guidelines are. And the CDC guidelines say that, first of all, you should look at your facility and try to implement a hierarchy of control to limit the number of people, both patients and staff, who are exposed to influenza-like illness. The second thing that you need to do is if you can't implement the hierarchy of controls, the last line of defense, or actually the last line in that hierarchy, is personal protective equipment. And that any time you are in a healthcare setting where you're within 6 feet of a patient, sort of, and I don't mean like just passing them in the hall, it's like in a room where you're within 6 feet of a patient with influenza-like illness, you should be wearing an N95. However, they also acknowledged, as New York State has been saying all along, that we don't have enough for that to always be the case. And because of that, there's a next level down. And the next level says, as long as you can demonstrate that you've made a good faith effort to obtain N95 respirators and can't get them, then you can prioritize what you use in your facility to only aerosol generating procedures. But if you have enough, you should be using them whenever you're within 6 foot of a patient with influenza-like illness. Is that clear?
I think so. And
so it's
clear like mud, but we'll get
there. Well, I mean, I guess my question to you, and I don't know where you're from, so, you know, do you have N95 respirators right now?
No, we're starting at ground zero, and we're putting a program into place, and we're grateful for your help. I think that my next question that goes along with that is then, we want to do what's in the best interest of the residents we're caring for and the staff that we have.
Right.
So common sense says if you have flu-like illness, you take precautions. Now, should we be preparing to use surgical masks if we can't get enough? And can you? I know you said before you can reuse the N95 as long as they're not visibly soiled, and I'm assuming not moist or
correct.
Wet.
Correct. Yes,
so
the answer to the reusing the N95 is true.
Okay.
And until you can get an N95 respirator, a surgical mask is going to provide you with at least some precautions.
Okay.
You know, some of the schools have, and I don't recommend this, but some of the schools have masked the student. But, you know, that's not the optimum thing to do. But again. Any way that you can, you know, protect people from breathing in what other people are exhaling is going to be better than nothing.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Sharon. Go ahead. Sharon, your line is open.
Hi. Hi, I have a question. A lot of it you've answered, but I want to clarify something. I work for a independent, standalone psychiatric facility. We do not generally have patients who would be under what we would call airborne precautions. Generally, we would, if we had someone who had TB or measles or chickenpox, they would be covered with a regular mask and they would be shipped to a medical facility since we cannot manage that kind of isolation. I recognize that influenza has traditionally just been droplet precautions, so we would have been able to manage that barring any serious complications. So my question is, and I just want to clarify, that we still need to implement some form of N95 setup, that we still need to fit test at least a small community of the healthcare providers in case we do get someone who has influenza-like illness, and because we would still need to treat them as if they have H1N1 or something which could be spread airborne.
That is correct. And at this point in time, there's some discussion as to whether it's droplet or airborne. And at this point in time, you know, there are schools of thought on both sides. However,
right. The
regulators are saying that they want people to wear N95s, and therefore we are providing assistance to help people understand what that means and what's required.
Okay, and I can contact, we're in Suffolk, so I can contact the local DOH and
correct.
And they'll work with me.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Excuse me, before we take the next call, Jason,
sure.
This is Cindy. Eileen, if you forward me the materials that we're talking about,
you can get them out to everyone?
We will post them on the website.
Perfect.
Or get them, send them out to the administrators or whatever. So
let me just, I just have one couple of quick changes to make to one of the programs,
okay.
So it may not be this afternoon, it might be tomorrow.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. I know that we have more questions, but I wanted to let everyone know that I do not know who is on the call because we don't have a list of people because people didn't register. So we'll probably just put it on our website or something, okay? So I'm going to go mute again.
Thank you, Cindy.
Yep.
Our next question comes from Barbara. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Eileen. When you're doing just routine open airway suctioning and there is no evidence or confirmation of a contagious diagnosis, is the N95 respirator still recommended or a surgical mask would do?
The N95 isn't needed for that. I'm not a nurse, so I don't know really how that works. But as far as it, not for the H1N1, no, and it's not recommended. I mean, you don't need to unless you have a person with influenza-like illness.
Okay, so if it's just like open airway suctioning and there's no sign of illness beyond their diagnosis, then...
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it's still just universal precautions, right? But, again, I'm not a nurse. I don't even play one on TV.
Okay, no, I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
It's only... Everything kicks in when there's a person with influenza-like illness.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next question comes from Eddie. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello, Eileen. I have two questions. I have two questions for you.
Okay.
The first question, if a caregiver is vaccinated, can they forego wearing a mask for routine care?
At this point in time, no one has stated that vaccination will remove the need to wear respiratory protection.
And, okay. And my second question, can we use a generic N95 mask?
I don't know what you mean by a generic N95 mask, but I can tell you that if it's NIOSH approved and it's an N95 mask, it's okay. As long as it has that NIOSH approval, it's fine.
Okay, and we still have to do a test fit.
Correct. Anytime you wear respiratory protection, you must have a respiratory protection program, which includes the written program, the training, the medical evaluation, the fit test.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome, Eddie.
Our next question comes from Gail. Go ahead.
Hi, Gail.
My question is, we have a vent unit.
Okay.
And it's closed system for suctioning or any inline treatment.
That's an engineering control. That's great.
Okay. So, therefore, if we have someone with an influenza-like illness, do we still need masks?
That's an engineering control, and from what I know, that eliminates the need for a mask.
Yahoo. Another question for you. Did I hear correctly you said you could store these N95s in a plastic bag?
Wait a second. I want to go back to your other question first.
Oh, okay.
There was a caveat before you jump up and down too high.
Oh.
Suctioning is not the only thing. There's also some other procedures, including CPR. So even though you may have a closed suctioning system, there may be other procedures that you're – I don't have that list in front of me.
CPR
is one of them. Yeah, I heard somebody whisper CPR. There's five or six different procedures. So you have to look at the different procedures. And then the second question was, can you
– Anytime you break the line then, really, you make that not a closed system. You would have to use a mask.
Yes.
Correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know what break the line means.
Take the person off the vent for any reason, take them off of the closed system.
Oh, okay. I would think so, if they're coughing.
Yes, if they have influenza-like illness.
Right, influenza illness and coughing. The other thing that you asked is, can you put the mask in a plastic bag?
Right.
Remember that when you're if you're reusing it, I mean, the optimum thing is to try to not have them laying around, but if you put, if you have one and you're going in and out of a room, I wouldn't just leave it laying on a counter or a table. I would slide it in a plastic bag for two reasons. One, to protect other people from anything that's on the outside of the respirator. But two, to protect my respirator from anything that somebody may drop on it or put around it. I want it to keep it clean.
Well, I kind of have a problem with that, though, because if you've got the viral stuff on the outside of the mask, and you put it in a bag, won't it also go on the inside?
Well, that's my hesitation with using the bag. I would want to make sure I always had the same side up, but it does create some inherent problems. But it's better than just leaving it laying on top of a counter.
Okay, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, there are obviously some problems with doing that. And again, I would, start to look to that when you're in strict priority mode.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Judith. Go ahead.
Well, she kind of asked my question, but we only have one kind of N95 mask at this time and having difficulty getting more. And we were going to initiate the priority mode when we had to. However, I'm having a whole big problem with putting the mask in a bag and then reusing it. And wouldn't it be safer to use a surgical mask if you, got down to the bare bones of your supply?
It's when we do the fit testing.
The fit test.
Where you have to have three different brands.
No, three different
sizes.
And
is this still the same question?
Small mm-hmm.
Now, she had the large. She got the large when she's waiting for the small.
Is this a question for me or is it just...
I don't know where that's coming from.
Oh, okay,
but
they're not in your group. I thought they were with your group. Okay.
No.
The question is, isn't it better to wear a surgical... Well, the thing you have to keep in mind is that the surgical mask does prevent exposure from any droplet nuclei.
Right.
You can still get around the side of
Yes, I know that, but if you're running low on N95 masks...
Then you should be prioritizing for just aerosol-generating procedures.
Yes.
And if you're still running low... That's when you'll be reaching out to your local health department and saying, look, I'm still doing aerosol-generating procedures. Surgical mask has not been effective. They're not saying to use a surgical mask for N90 for aerosol-generating procedures.
Okay, but if for any other kind of direct care?
Then, yes, you can use them, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, when I say to put the N95 in a plastic bag, it's not like, a pair of shoes that you've been carrying around for 6 months. You might have a respirator you're using for like a two-hour time period, and, you're just sort of sliding it in there just to keep it from being contaminated or spilled on or dropped from other staff. The thing is that it's not for long periods of time.
Mm.
It might
and had to reuse the mask a second time, you would probably have to use a new plastic bag.
That's a good idea.
Okay. I'm happy. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, our next question comes from Karen. Go ahead.
Okay, maybe you've answered this. I'm not sure because we're getting very confused. We have N95 respirators. We have plenty of them. So our question, what our plan was, is to begin fit testing and then to use them only for our residents who need a nebulizer treatment or suctioning. Is that okay to do and then have other staff use regular masks, or do we have to use the N95s for all care for those residents?
If you have plenty, and I don't know what plenty is, but if you have plenty, then you should be using them for when you have contact with a person with influenza-like illness. As your plenty supply starts to diminish and you realize that you may not be able to get more, you would immediately go into prioritization mode. If you feel you have plenty, then you really shouldn't be prioritizing. The people that don't have any or have very limited supplies would be in priority mode.
Okay. Can we just ask one second question? For anyone who's entering the particular resident room, housekeeper, maybe a food service worker, they too will need to be fit tested?
It says in the beginning of the CDC guidelines, and what PESH and OSHA have said that they are going to enforce is that yes. And that's why I would look at trying to limit the number of people that go in and out of a person with influenza-like illness room, rather than have, you know, all of your food service staff have to be fit, test, and trained. You may decide that the nurse or the CMA would be the person that delivers the food for that specific person. So limiting the amount of people going in and out.
Okay, thank you.
So the thing is to look at the way you do business, and that's why we've acknowledged that there is a need to go into priority mode, because if it's business as usual, you're going to run out really quickly, and there are not going to be enough for the procedures like the aerosol-generating procedures where you really need it, and there is no substitution. So you need to look at your facility now and figure out a way to use the hierarchy of controls to change the way you do business so that the amount of respirators you would need would be limited as much as possible.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, our next question comes from Tracy. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, you mentioned that you might be implementing a computerized training program, and if so, do you have a projected target date for that?
Yesterday.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Well, in all actuality, we're working with the BOCES people now. We're trying to train 350 school nurses, and this decision was made 2 days ago. To do it, I already have a template for the training. We just have to figure out a time when we can actually sit down and video it.
Okay. All right, that would be wonderful.
Yeah,
that's
I just
it.
Thought it would be something for the long term.
Okay.
And nobody wants to have to watch a one-hour show every time.
Well, I'm concerned for, you know, all the different shifts and the per diems and whatnot. I think it would be very beneficial. So, and I think to for training the trainers and... So I appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Next, we have Cassie. Cassie, your line is now open.
Yes, I work in a long-term care facility, and we have per diem staff who either work in other facilities or even in hospitals. And I just wondered if they had already been fit tested in another facility, can we utilize them and accept their documentation, providing that we give them the same mask that they're fit tested for?
That's a good question. As long as you have the information that says that they are fit tested by the other facility, you know what? That's one of those weird compliance questions. I mean, it's easy for me to say, of course, I would accept it. But I don't know if the regulators would. But if they're per diem, then they're probably going from facility to facility. I guess, I don't, you know, it's a hard to give that answer. I don't see any downsides except somebody say, well, you're the employer, you have to do it. But the fact is they're still fit tested. I guess the onus is on the employer to make sure their employees have it. You know, that would be a specific OSHA question.
Okay.
Because they're the ones that are really going to look into it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that's getting down to... you know, really very, you know, minutia. If that's your only problem, you're doing pretty good.
No, it isn't, but I wish it was.
So, you know, it's really getting down into the weeds.
Yeah.
You know, as long as, I think that's probably pretty far down.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
And next we have Beth. Go ahead.
The September 18th health advisory from the Department of Health says that the N95 only needs to be used for aerosol-generating procedures. So what you're telling us today, or in New York, is disagreeing with CDC. They're saying for everything else, you just need to follow droplet. So OSHA regulations will overrule that?
OSHA is the regulator for occupational health.
Mm-hmm.
And OSHA has come out and said, I'm not sure which directive you're talking about from the state health department, but the thing is that the CDC's original guidance did not take into account the fact that there's limited amounts of respirators out there. And the thing is that the CDC is now, they came out on October 14th with guidance that was different from their spring guidance, and they're acknowledging the fact that aerosol-generating procedures are the highest risk for people to be exposed. OSHA and PESH are the ones that set the regulatory agenda. So if they're saying that this is what they're enforcing, then we're just providing you with the information for what they're enforcing.
Okay, because I'm just confused because it's very specific here. It says the New York State Department of Health recommends healthcare personnel follow droplet precautions by wearing a surgical face mask, while the CDC recommends that healthcare personnel wear a fit tested N95 respirator. It's a health advisory. It's dated September 18th.
Okay.
And clinical guidance for healthcare providers.
But I can tell you that what you will be responsible for and what you would be cited for. It's like if I live on a street, and again, and I say, you know, I think the speed limit is 30 is fine. It doesn't matter what I think. I mean, if you will be responsible to adhere to what the regulators say. And what we're doing is we're providing you with the information on what the regulators say.
Okay. It's just confusing why New York State would say one thing, and we've got.
I don't remember
CDC.
That guidance from September.
Yeah, it's September. It's clinical guidance for healthcare providers for the 2009-2010 flu season.
I know we are looking at the CDC guidelines, and there may be another one of those that come out.
No, this is New York State, their advisory.
Okay, yeah, no, I know that the State Health Department, New York State Health Department, is looking at the CDC guidelines now, and there may be another advisory that comes out.
Okay,
so,
okay.
I mean, but at this point in time, the regulators are really what you need to follow because they're the ones that you're going to be responsible for sort of fessing up to as to what you did and didn't do. And at this point in time, both OSHA and PESH have stated that they will be enforcing what the CDC guidelines recommend.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have two final follow-ups. Our first is from Sonia. Go ahead. Sonia, your line is open.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think my question was answered. But anyway, I just need a little bit more clarification. For the influenza, is it the confirmed case that we're insisting that we use the N95 or just the influenza-like illness?
Sonny, it's just the influenza-like illness. We are not requiring people to be confirmed at all. We are just saying that if people are exhibiting the symptoms of influenza-like illness, then they would fall under the guidelines. And what we're determining to be influenza-like illness is greater than 100 degrees fever and sore throat or cough.
Okay, thanks. And I still have that concern, like the prior caller with DOH versus CDC. So we have to wait until we get the update.
Okay, yes.
Right.
Hopefully that will all be clarified as the Department of Health update.
Right, because with a nursing home with 460 beds to get every CNA tested, that's going to be a big task.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And next we have Zaini. Go ahead.
Yes, I have two questions. If a resident has flu-like symptoms, what are we going to do with the roommate if they are in a two-bedded room?
I would say that you could look back for the engineering controls and perhaps put up, like, a partition between them. I mean, I'm assuming the beds are not within 6 feet.
Will a curtain suffice?
Yes, it will. If you look at the CDC guidelines, it talks about, under engineering controls, the use of a curtain.
Okay, another question. Is there such a thing as a one-size-fits-all N95 respirator?
No, not like a training bra. Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
I mean, there may be like a universe. I know that there's some places that sell like a, you know, a medium and then a regular, but regular is not one-size-fits-all. Regular is kind of like, and I mean, it depends on regular from manufacturer to manufacturer. So there is no, you know, it, one size does not fit all. There may be one size they sell, but it does not fit all. Or maybe their little tagline should say more along the lines of one size fits many.
Oh, thank you.
One size fits me.
Okay.
Our
final question is from Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is regarding the home care setting. We have an entity where more nurses' aides or home health aides would go into the home setting. Should we be fit testing them if we suspect, if they show up at somebody's door, they might not know that the person has symptoms till they get there. So it's a little bit of a gray area. So should we just prophylactically fit test these employees and have that available to them when they are going into the home?
I believe on the front of the CDC guidelines, it talks about home health care facilities as health care workers. And since you don't know if the patient that they're going to see in the home health care is ILI, then it's probably a good idea to, it is a good idea from the precautionary side to have them be ready to put it on if they need it.
Okay, thank you.
And at this time, there are no further questions.
All right.
Okay, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. This is Cindy from NEASA. We'll work with Eileen to get everything posted to our website as soon as we can. Probably not until next week sometime, perhaps. But I'd like to thank Eileen for being patient with us and taking all of our questions today. And thank you very much.
Thank you for setting it up.
No problem. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Officially ends the call. Have a good day.
Thank you, Jason. Bye-bye.